Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
The Big Chief with a badge, a cattle prod and a head on a stick.
Dangerous mid-morning debate with the Great Dictator.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. We step into spring this week. It's going to be the spring equinox tomorrow, March the 21st, which is really the beginning of all that is great about the summer weather and the summer season. It's already feeling a little bit warmer as we speak. However, it's a very chill wind that's blowing down Westminster way, because in Downing Street, Theresa May is in power and not in office, or in office but not in power, whichever way round that should be. Basically, she has no authority. It's all been stripped away from her. She has no credibility. She's going to ask for a delay to Brexit, but nobody knows how long for. Some people in the Houses of Parliament say that she should be getting a delay for a long time. She doesn't want to get one longer than June. She doesn't really understand what it is that she wants to do. She doesn't really understand what it is that her own party want her to do. And she doesn't really get the fact that we are all looking at her with a mixture of a sort of revulsion and incredulity, because we can't actually believe that she can be so bad at her job and not realise that she's so bad at her job. So I'm saying to you today, not for the first time, finally, it is time to go. Please just leave, Theresa. You've done all you can do with no rancour, with no hostility. Please just walk away from the job and leave it to somebody who can actually achieve something, because you, I'm afraid, have achieved the square root of absolutely nothing. 0344 499 1000 is the number. Meanwhile, out there are some other things to worry about. It's a bit more of a dangerous world in which we now live, despite Brexit or because of Brexit. Despite the EU or because of the EU, Turkey, of course, a country that the European Union wanted to co-opt as a member of the expanded European Union, we now have President Erdogan saying that he's going to send Westerners home in coffins. Now, that may just be political rhetoric, but it's the kind of language that should not be used when it comes to Muslim preparations and the problems that we have with all sorts of terrorist organisations in his part of the world. Absolutely staggering stuff. 0344 499 1000. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now let's talk to Dr. Paul Stott, Research Fellow at the Centre on Radicalisation and Terrorism, member of the Henry Jackson Society. The world, of course, has been filled with images from New Zealand and that terrible event that happened down in Christchurch, where 50 people were shot dead, innocently worshipping at the local mosques in that part of the world. All sorts of things have kicked off since then. There's been widespread revulsion around the world at what happened down there. But of course, President Erdogan has gone slightly the other way and started talking about things like conspiracies against Muslims. He's talking about Gallipoli, because of course the Second World War battleground was going to be very much a part of the commemoration ceremonies that go on every single year in April. And it's really quite unfortunate that he started to use the kind of language that is likely to cause what you might regard as a breach, at the very least, of international diplomacy. Dr. Paul, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. What is he about, President Erdogan? Because he's variously described as a guy who, on the one hand, wants to kind of appeal to his home supporters, as it were, in Turkey, who can be quite hardline Islamic fundamentalists. And at the same time, he wants to be recognised in the rest of the world as the man who's kind of bringing Turkey to the table, if you like.
Well, in a way, this is precisely what he's done this week, in that he's written an article in the Washington Post on the Christchurch attacks, which is comparatively sensible and in a lot of ways unremarkable.
Yeah.
And then at Turkish election rallies, which he's been holding, he's been behaving in a most remarkable way and saying some extremely problematic and provocative things that have really led to a diplomatic breach with both Australia and New Zealand.
Right.
And I mean, firstly, for example, there's very little point in getting social media companies to take down footage of the terrorist attacks on the mosques if the president of Turkey is going to put them on a large screen at his own rallies.
And well, that was one of the more remarkable things I read this morning when I was hearing about all of this. And the idea that he would do that is extraordinary, isn't it?
It is, and it completely undermines the pressure that companies like Facebook and YouTube have been put on, and it derails the debate about their responsibility towards users and their need to tackle extremist material. But it's also the case with Erdogan that he seems to be trying to make sort of much more political connections between the attacker and Australia and New Zealand as countries,
right.
Which is pretty weak, really. This is somebody who doesn't seem to have been a member of a broader political party and who has next to no support for his ideas. I mean, for example, in the manifesto that the gunman wrote, he's talking about retaking Constantinople, which is what Istanbul used to be called when it was Christian. You know, the idea that large numbers of Australians or New Zealanders are planning to do that is just nonsense. But when you watch the footage of Erdogan's rallies, that seems to be what he believes. And he's talking about, you know, if people come to Turkey to do this, they'll be sent back in caskets as people were in the First World War at Gallipoli.
Yeah.
And Gallipoli, to Australians and indeed to New Zealanders, is sort of part of the foundation of their country.
Absolutely right. And it seems in particularly poor taste, doesn't it, Paul, to bring it up at this time, because it's in April, I think, that the commemorations go on. And he was actually giving a speech supposedly commemorating Gallipoli in the first place.
Yes, it's April 25th, what's known as ANZAC Day,
yeah.
And hundreds, thousands travel from Australia and New Zealand to Gallipoli. The founder of Turkey, Atatürk, said at the time when the commemorative stone and the graves were being established that they would be revered, that they would be treated as they treat their own sons. And I think there's a feeling certainly been expressed by the Australian Foreign Minister that Turkey now seems to be changing its position, because these are indirect threats that are being made to Australians and New Zealanders who may travel, and that's deeply regrettable.
No, of course. And it is, in a way, two different countries, as you've quite rightly pointed out, you know, the kind of the Washington Post representation of Erdogan and then the one that he speaks at sort of nationalist rallies, where you've got a lot of British families probably preparing to go out to visit various resorts in Turkey over the next few weeks when Easter holidays are around, because partly it's one of the hottest parts of the Mediterranean to go to. And then you go to somewhere like Istanbul, and I remember when Jamal Khashoggi was murdered there by the Saudi Arabians in the embassy, it was pointed out there was a bit of hypocrisy going on because there are so many journalists imprisoned in Turkey by Erdogan that he can hardly present himself as a kind of a liberal voice of democracy.
No, Turkey is a sort of pseudo-democracy.
Yeah.
It's not a liberal democracy. In a way, it has some characteristics perhaps in common with somewhere like Putin's Russia, that you've got this sort of strongman figure who appeals to a distinct base, and then others who are outside of that base are treated very poorly. So you obviously have the point you've just made about journalists, but also academics. Turkey's jailed hundreds of academics in recent years. There's also the further problem that a series of European countries have really tired of Erdogan and Turkey, because Erdogan wishes to campaign in Germany, in Austria, in Holland to get the votes of Turkish exiles there, and it's been damaging integration policies in those countries.
Yeah. And what about the kind of the diplomatic view of Turkey in general, because it's not that long ago since Angela Merkel was making noises about inviting them into the EU and trying to make them more kind of compliant, if you like, with Western values. That's all kind of gone away now, hasn't it?
Well, there's two issues, really. There's the fact that Turkey is still applying to be a member of the European Union, but also that Turkey is a member of NATO.
Yeah.
And I think in recent years, we've begun to look much more critically at Erdogan and where he's taken his party, the AKP, in this much more sort of pious direction and a much more anti-Western direction. So there's actually some doubt necessarily about whether he actually believes he can get membership of the European Union. But what we've begun to see in Austria, in Germany and Holland is evidence emerging of Turkish intelligence operations in those countries that are deeply damaging, the targeting of Turkish political dissidents, targeting of the Kurds, the use of Turkish religious buildings and organizations to develop intelligence on those dissidents, a sort of spook imams, which I think is probably a first. And in 2018, Austria actually closed 7 mosques and announced it was going to expel 60 Turks for doing this.
Right.
So you're getting into the sort of situation we used to be with the Soviet Union, you know, where diplomats are being seen, or religious figures in this instance, are being seen as hostile to the countries that they're in.
Right. It's a very strange sort of uneasy calm I feel at the moment about all of this, you know, because there are so many sort of touch points in the Middle East now. We've got ISIS supposedly in retreat, very much being told, well, we're being told that they're finished as a force, but they still keep popping up from place to place. We've got Syrian problems still going on. You know, Iran has still not really been solved. Israel is still in a state of flux. I mean, there's quite a lot of tinder boxes out there without me wishing to kind of raise a flag on anything here.
I think that's right. In a way, very little has been decisively resolved.
Mm.
And, I mean, it's interesting listening to Erdogan, and he's talking about what Turkey's done against Islamic State.
Yeah.
And whilst that's been very important and has helped really sort of knock them down, the reality is that Turkey was very slow to the party in terms of taking action against jihadists in Syria and really allowed pretty free access via its southern border into Syria for, you know, foreign fighters who wish to go and fight for a long time. And it was only really when some of the Western countries put their feet to the fire that they properly closed their border.
Right. And is Turkey becoming more polarised, do you think, as a result of what Erdogan is doing and saying?
Very much so. And, you know, you mentioned people going off on holiday to Turkey and whatever.
Yeah.
And in a way, they'll probably miss all of this because you've got, if you like, a more sort of European, secular, Western-leaning section that, you'll find in those holiday resorts. You'll find in some of the big cities. But his base is very much in the rural areas and among more conservative and older Turks, and you know, there's some big political differences between those two groups, and his use of the video from Christchurch and some of the rhetoric, some of it seems to be about actually bashing and playing down, you know, attacking those internal political opponents in Turkey as well.
Yeah, it's very, very strange indeed. And one final question for you, Dr. Paul, just slightly off to the side. You probably noticed Donald Trump was meeting with the Brazilian new leader, Jair Bolsonaro. He's apparently suggested that maybe they should invite Brazil to join NATO. What do you make of that? Is that just a Trumpism, or do you think that's on the cards?
I suspect that probably is a Trumpism. I think, I mean, there are sort of long-term questions about Turkey's membership, but I'm not sure that adding Brazil is necessarily where we want to go. It's a North American and European alliance, and not one that really historically has taken in Latin America.
No, OK. Dr. Paul Stott, thank you very much indeed. Research Fellow at the Centre for Radicalisation and Terrorism, a member of the Henry Jackson Society. Erdogan, says San, who's tweeted us at Talk Radio, is the same as he always has been, a divisive person who will do and say anything that will get his AKP party re-elected. He continues with his extreme right-wing rhetoric, which finds home with uneducated nationalists in Turkey. The West needs to wake up to the danger posed by him. Well, certainly, when you read some of the things that he's been saying, talking about the shooting down in Christchurch, he called on New Zealand to hand down, in his words, a proper punishment to the white supremacist. He says, "You have nefariously, perfidiously and vulgarly killed 50 of our praying brothers. You will pay for this. If New Zealand fails to do so one way or another, we will make you pay for it," he said, referring to the killer, who, of course, is not going to be named by the New Zealand Prime Minister, so I won't bother naming him either, because I'd rather he rotted in hell anonymously, to be honest.
More gun talk from a water pistol from the Farmer of Fury.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham
on Talk Radio.
They call me hell. They call me Stacey. They call me her. They call me Jane.
This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Got some great tweets to read out to you on the Brexit front, but we're going to take a little break from Brexit for the moment, even though Prime Minister's questions will be happening in about 10 minutes' time, just over that. Ross Kempsall, our political editor, of course, here at Talk Radio, will be here to talk us through what Theresa May is going to say, what Jeremy Corbyn is going to say, what the likelihood is of anything actually changing the situation vis-a-vis Brexit, vis-a-vis Brussels, and whether or not the letter that she wants to write will actually be written before the close of play today. It really is quite a ludicrous situation, I have to say. And I've been calling for the Theresa May resignation letter now for at least 2 hours, and maybe we should be calling for it all throughout the course of this weekend, because there's a lot of pressure inside the Conservative Party and inside the Cabinet from people who think that she may have actually run her course, and it may well be time for her just to step aside. No rancour, you know, absolutely no violent outbursts, no insults, just say, look, Theresa, you've done your best, please just now step aside, because it's time for somebody else to take over. But can you imagine if the person that was to take over had a first name, and that name was Lucifer? Because we're going to talk to Lorna Marshdale, senior editor at the Baby Centre, because apparently somebody wanted to call their son Lucifer and did so quite successfully. Lorna, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Hi there.
I can't really imagine calling somebody Lucifer, but I mean, I guess it's only relatively recently, and when I mean recently, I mean the last couple of hundred years, that people probably thought Lucifer was a bad name.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing with names. They go in cycles and they go in trends. And while Lucifer isn't one of the trends we've predicted...
It just sounds funny to hear it. You know, this is my son. I mean, even Damien, even though... Because I'm a sort of child of the 70s, I suppose, Damien still means the omen to me. And if ever I meet anybody called Damien, or they've got kids called Damien, I always just give them a funny look and just think, really? Is that the best name you could come up with?
And yet its meaning has now kind of come to mean quite a cool, trendy baby name.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, cool, trendy baby names. I mean, my daughter's called Emma, right? And she's now 28. And there was a time when she was born in America. But we moved, and it was a very unusual name in America. We moved back to London. And when she was about 5, you would call out Emma in the playground. And there'd be about 15 kids would turn around, you know, because everyone was called Emma.
Absolutely. My son's name is Charlie, which is now one of the... now one of our top 10.
Right.
But at the time it felt unusual, especially because of the diminutive form. But yes, I had the same issue as you. There were a couple of Charlies in his class. Yeah.
And I mean, when I was growing up, Charlie was a name you called somebody who was a bit of an idiot. You call him a proper Charlie. But I mean, that doesn't happen anymore because, of course, we're much more respectful of each other nowadays. But what about the kind of the unusual names? I mean, I was talking to some of the guys here at Talk Radio, and I remember there was a case, I think, in France, relatively recently, the last couple of years, where a judge actually prevented parents from calling their daughter Nutella. Do you remember that?
I read that too, and I think it's now on France's banned list because I believe, unlike the UK, France does have a list of banned names, including things like Nutella and strawberry as well.
Yeah, that's weird, isn't it? Because you've got, I mean, a lot of the kind of the rock star, you've got Apple, who was Chris Martin, I think, and Gwyneth Paltrow's daughter. You know, and I remember going all the way back to Frank Zappa, where he had Moon Unit Zappa and, you know, Zoe Bowie and all these kinds of names from rock star names. But, I mean, I don't think they've ever stopped it from happening here, have they? There's never been a case where, a court has stepped in and said, you can't call your child that.
Well, not that we know of. I mean, there may have been cases where parents try to get their name registered and we're told they can't. And that's something we probably wouldn't know about, you know, publicly. Parents can appeal against that, which I guess is then when it may go to court and that the case may then kind of come into the public domain. But as far as I know, I don't think that's ever happened.
Right.
We do have a kind of general rule that a name's only stopped in exceptional cases, either if it's offensive or if it would kind of cause harm to the child involved.
Right. And that doesn't really happen very often, I suppose, does it?
Who knows? Well, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I mean, if a child did want to if a parent did want to name their baby something embarrassing, it would be stopped, so we wouldn't know about it. But I don't think parents generally do set out embarrassing.
No, the baby centre's done this study in Scotland, and it's found that basically Olivia was Scotland's most popular girl's name, which is lovely, and Jack for boys, which is kind of old-fashioned, really, isn't it?
Yeah. The top 10 for us, for boys and girls, does tend to be very stable. Mm. It's kind of further outside there that we tend to see more unusual names on the rise.
Yeah.
I think parents like to play it fairly safe with their child's names for obvious reasons.
Yeah, I mean, you have to also imagine what they're going to be like, as adults as well, because some names which sound cute for children may not quite transcend and transition into adulthood.
Yeah, that's true. But then taking the case of Apple, as you mentioned earlier, who knows, that could, you know, take on a whole other meaning. Not a meaning, but a tone. As the child grows up and as that name becomes more popular, it just becomes normalised for an adult to have that name. So,
well, it sounds also like it could be the company rather than the fruit. You know, in which case,
yes.
You know, it's all very well being a slave to the iPhone, but that makes it ridiculous. So what about one of the names you found in your study, Awesome? I mean, that's ridiculous, isn't it?
It's not something I might choose, but who knows? The child,
I mean,
it's
presumably so you can go up to somebody and go, "Hi, I'm Awesome." And they go, we know.
What we have found, actually, one of the trends we have found is increasingly shortened names.
Right.
So maybe Awesome is going to be, shortened to Aussie or Aus.
Yes, yeah. Not working for me. And what about I mean, much anticipation about the royal birth coming up. That always leads to something akin to a sort of a stampede of people naming their kids after the royals, right?
Yes. So last year when we had Prince Louis being born, Louis became a new entry at number 91 for us.
Hmm.
So the royal influence is always felt when there's a new baby or a wedding. We had in 2017, going back just a couple of years, George and Charlotte shot up as well.
Yeah.
So we're definitely influenced by that. But I think there's also a case of the royals being influenced now, the younger royals, by what is fashionable.
Right. And is there any, because it's a very much a sort of, I don't know, a conversation that the media is having, whether it's being repeated outside the media kind of sort of telescopic state, is the whole kind of gender fluidity thing. I know that in America, where I was recently, there's an awful lot of people who are not giving their kids names which have a specific gender.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because we noticed a huge trend last year in gender-neutral names.
Really?
Yeah, Harley being the biggest one by far. I mean, to my mind, Harley was—it's always quite a male name because of Harley Davidson.
Yeah.
But then, of course, we've had Harley from, and I can't remember the name of the film, but it's one of the big Marvel or DC films.
Oh, okay.
That shot up for boys and girls, which was really interesting.
That is interesting.
I think the split was 51% girls and 49% boys.
Mm.
So we're seeing a lot of gender-neutral names as that kind of debate carries on.
Yeah, interesting.
Well,
it's fascinating times, and hopefully whoever it is that is born Lucifer will go on to do many good things and not live up to the devil-worshipping side of things. But Lorna, thank you very much indeed. Lorna Marsh, Senior Editor at Baby Centre. Imagine calling one of your kids Lucifer. I mean, it just doesn't seem right, does it?
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile.
Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Dangerous mid-morning debate with the Great Dictator.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Because of the wild, I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles.
You're listening to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio in association with The Times. It's politics tamed, and we've got loads more to do on the political front. I've just been handed the letter that Theresa May has sent to Donald Tusk, and I have to tell you, it is possibly one of the most boring documents I've ever read in my entire life. Here's the opening paragraph, right? Dear Donald, the UK government's policy remains to leave the European Union in an orderly manner on the basis of the withdrawal agreement and political declaration agreed in November, complemented by the joint instrument and supplement to the political declaration President Juncker and I agreed on the 11th of March. For God's sake, I mean, talk about pulling them in with the first paragraph. I mean, you know, call me old-fashioned, but that is probably the worst possible first paragraph that I have ever heard or seen written down. For God's sake, listen, we've had an alert, I'm afraid. It is now time to check in with the countdown clock to see how long before it is that we don't leave the European Union and nothing happens. Well, it doesn't look like anything's happening, but it's still only 9 days away from nothing happening. And, of course, Theresa May is now asking for an extension so that nothing can happen a bit later on, closer to June the 30th. Dear God, let's talk to Roy who's in the Wirral. Hello, Roy.
Hiya, Mike. Hey. There's one lady who can't see for miles and miles.
No, I know. She can't see the end of her nose, for heaven's sake.
God's truth. Anyway, NHS, mate.
Yes.
Yeah. I've had ongoing back problems. I did my discs and swimming in the sea and things like that. Anyway, cut a long story short, yeah. Been going on for the best part of maybe 8, 9, 10 years in lower spinal area, you know,
yes.
Particularly painful.
Very painful and very difficult disabling. To sit down, I would imagine.
Well, anyway. I've been sent to a couple of different physio classes, you know, where you climb a mock pair of stairs and you do this and that, you know, and you do squats and sit on a rubber ball and all that. So I ended up going to the GP and said to him, I said, could I just have this looked at? Can I have it find out exactly what's going on in the back?
Right.
And his first comment was, why? Do you want to end up with surgery?
Right. Well, surely that's what
which
you
is
just
a little
want
bit
it fixed.
Off-putting, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah.
It is a little bit off-putting.
Yeah, yeah. But that's why they do
so
it, because
anyway,
they want you to stop asking for stuff.
I know, yeah. So he said, what I'll do, he said, I'll refer you to the pain clinic.
All right. Yeah, that sounds
so
a bit
I've
worrying.
So I've been referred to something called the pain clinic.
The pain clinic.
Oh, no.
Who's in charge of that? Joseph Mengele.
It's just what the physios do with the laptop.
Right.
But anyway, but let me tell you, I'll give you another example and then I'll go. Right. My daughter phoned me this morning that my granddaughter's particularly poorly. We've got to phone the GPs at 8 in the morning to get an appointment. So I phoned at 8 in the morning. Now, my granddaughter's throat's been swabbed and everything because she's got a terrible time. She's only 6.
Right.
So I phoned this morning. Could I possibly have an appointment? So preferably after lunch. No appointment at all. And there's none whatsoever. There's no surgery this afternoon.
Mm.
They've got the doctors have gone to a meeting.
No, for God's sake.
I said, can you get me to another surgery? Appointment with another surgery. Yeah. Hang on, I'll have a look. Saturday, 11 o'clock.
Unbelievable. It really is.
About a six-year-old child.
It's quite depressing.
Who was missing school. It was poorly.
I know. And, of course, we get the NHS for excuses, saying, oh, well, that's just unfortunate. It's not like that all the time. Well, it is like that all the time, Roy. Thanks for the call. Let's talk to Neil in Macclesfield. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Mike. All right.
Yeah, not bad, mate. What have you got for us?
I think the thing with Theresa May, she just reflects everything that's wrong with our, public services, culture at the moment. You know,
yeah.
Incompetence is actually rewarded. You know, we're talking about the NHS and all that sort of thing. And it's right across all public sector, all the councils, all the quangos, all the NHS trusts. Every single way you look, there are people in high-powered jobs getting paid way, way more than they were getting private industry, and they do an appalling job, and somehow that is just acceptable. You know, they just get...
I said this the other day. I had a rant about the fact that we've got all these people now working in all these jobs and none of them know what they're doing. None of them can actually do their job.
Yeah. I mean, the BBC is another case in point. I've got a good BBC story for you.
Go on.
A few years ago, I met a BBC producer and he said they were looking at commissioning a pirate drama.
Right.
So they got all of the... they got about 20 of their... technical staff together, and they went out to the Bahamas and the Caribbean to look at some locations and shots and that kind of thing. So they spent about 2 months out there getting drunk and spending money on expenses, and then they came back and they said, well, how did you get on then? And they said, oh, well, we couldn't find anywhere. We'll have to go back next year.
Sounds great. Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous,
and
isn't
it? And we're paying for it.
Well, of course we are. But the point is that, you know, if you want to do a pirate drama, why don't you just go down to Cornwall? There are pirates there.
Caribbean. No. You've got to go to Jamaica, mate.
Yeah, you go to Jamaica Inn. It's closer. You know, I think you'll find. But anyway, listen, Neil, thank you very much indeed. Neil in Macclesfield there with the story about somebody you met from the BBC. I mean, this goes on all the time in all kinds of industries and all kinds of places. And I don't really care if people do it. I just don't think they should be doing it with our money. That's the problem.
Anyone can fall in love. That's the easy part. You must keep it going.
That's worth about 27 million of our money, isn't it? Imagine Anita Dobson singing the song. I had no idea it was an actual song. Blimey. We've got the news this morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry to tell you, as if our public servants are not wasting enough money, it turns out the BBC have managed to overrun their set rebuilding project up in North London by about 27 million quid. Now, ordinarily speaking, I work for a broadcast organisation. If anybody in this organisation was £27 over budget, there would be hell to pay. The idea that it goes 27 million over budget is completely and utterly extraordinary. I'm delighted to say that we've got Meg Hillier with us, Chair of the Public Accounts Select Committee, to talk us through how on earth this has happened. Meg, a very good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for joining us. I mean, I'm right to say, am I not, that in any private organisation, and people have said, well, you know, ITV revamped their Coronation Street set, you know, you would have a much tighter budget control process, but also you wouldn't have that kind of money to play around with. And this is our money, after all.
Well, it certainly is. It's a licence fee payers' money, and one of the reasons we look at it is for that reason. I mean, I have to say, the point is that we can see what the BBC is doing. We can't see what every private company is doing, but that's because it's taxpayers' money, whether it's through the licence fee or not, that's being spent. And in this case, I mean, you know, the BBC have said that they weren't complacent. We think, well, they were really slow at the start to understand what needed to be done and to properly manage that. And if you were managing an extension in your home, you'd think it through and think about you might need the plumbing done, you might need the electrics done, and you'd think about all the things that might go wrong that you might need to think about setting some money aside for. And they didn't do that, and that has been one. And every delay then can cost money. And there are some things everything they've said that they've uncovered, like asbestos and things like that, very important things that you can't completely predict, but we still say you should be able to plan that you might have those things go wrong, and some of them were predictable. Look, it took them 6 months to work out exactly what to do about the bricks when they finally got the contractor on board, and that's a 6 months delay, and all those delays cost public money.
And who's supposed to be in charge of the project, Meg? Is there an individual? Is there a BBC committee? Who is it?
Yeah, well, we spoke to the individuals in charge. Ultimately, of course, the Director General has oversight of the whole thing, but there were people along the way in charge of bits of it, and that was one of the problems, that there wasn't really a strong team with proper project management skills. But ultimately, I mean, the board overall, the BBC head people have to take responsibility for something that was supposed to be a two-year site. So, you know, originally it was built, just thrown up quick and cheap, you know. Well, I don't suppose it was that cheap, but that was 35 years ago now.
Yeah.
And now, here we are, 35 years on. Now, they could have predicted some time ago that they might have needed to do something about a site that was supposed to be there for 2 years and it's still knocking on 35 years on. Mm. So they knew this was coming. It's a major flagship for them. It has still over 6 million viewers. And speaking as a London MP, and in fact, Albert Square was modelled on Bassett Square in Hackney, in my constituency. So it's absolutely critical that I think that we have a London.
Listen, my place in London's on the East Ender's map, you know. So don't worry about that. But nevertheless, I mean, I'm a veteran of watching old TV sitcoms when they slammed the door shut and the whole thing shook. I don't mind that. Yeah. You know, I don't care whether they've got something more solid than that. To be honest, I mean, can they not do it slightly cheaper?
Well, I think it's good. Yeah, maybe, but I think it's we're certainly getting to the point of being a bit dangerous. And also, we've got a pretty. I mean, you and I. May not work. I remember the old Doctor Who's and all that, you know, the cardboard set. My kids are a bit more sophisticated than that. Netflix and that lot are giving the BBC a run for their money. So, they needed to think about doing something about it, but they have known for 35 years that this would be looming at once they realised it was a success. So they needed to plan properly further ahead and make sure that they'd nailed down certain things. It is complex. You've got to have plot lines that fit in with the fact that you're rebuilding the set. You know, these are not difficult, easy things to do. But
no, I'm sure they're not. But nevertheless, I mean, this is getting sort of coming up to HS2 proportions. Yep. They're telling us it's not going to be done by 2023.
Yep, that's the problem. It's now 5 years late, as well as £27 million over budget. And when the BBC is, you know, they're struggling, having this big debate about whether to pay the 75 plus the licence fee for people who are over 75, and they've got £27 million that didn't all need to be wasted on an overrun on this. They just didn't plan it properly from the beginning. You know, but there is an opportunity here. Some of your listeners may be interested to know that there's a second site on the Elstree site that's going to be developed, which will develop new plot lines. So if you do live in the East Enders area, you might think, what would be the modern East London that they ought to be reflecting on the BBC now?
Yeah,
so these are things that will happen down the line, but as you say, not for some time.
Are they going to have a sort of mini Canary Wharf thing going on?
Well, I think they're open for suggestion. I'm certainly going to talk to my local school children and say, what do you think that East Enders should reflect as your real life now? Because, you know, Albert Square, yeah, doesn't quite reflect the London, the Hackney and East London that I know. But the point is here, it's tax, it's public money. They needed to, there's a sort of, and it's not just the BBC. We see this on my committee all the time. It's like other people spending other people's money. And this is our money, your money, my money, my constituents' money. And, you know, you need to think, if it was your own home, you wouldn't want to waste this much money, would you?
No, exactly. And have you actually now got sort of a grip of it, as it were? Are you able to bring these people, haul them before the Public Accounts Committee if they don't do what they've promised to do?
Well, this is the second time we've done it, and 3 years ago there was already a delay, and this delay is now extended. So we have asked for them for an annual update on how things are going, and, you know, shown them, told them really that we're going to keep a very close eye on it now. We, you know, unfortunately, we tend to see, we have to look at the way it works a bit. We have to look at the numbers after they've spent the money, and then sometimes that's too late. But the bigger message here is all of these big projects need proper project management, and it needs to be actually sometimes up front, say it's going to cost more than sometimes we hear. Sometimes there's I don't think it was the case in this one, but sometimes they try to keep the price down because it sounds too bad to go out to the public and say it's going to cost a lot of money. It's like rebuilding Parliament.
Yeah.
Some of these projects are going to be costly, but let's be honest about the cost and then keep it to those costs.
Well, that would be good, because as soon as I mentioned on Twitter that I was going to be talking about this subject, I mean, there's an awful lot of people out there who are fed up to the back teeth of the BBC and the amount of money they charge for their licence fee and the sort of arrogance with which they operate their budgets. And a lot of people now saying, surely we should be rethinking the whole licence fee scenario, and this doesn't really help their cause, does it?
Well, no, certainly I know the BBC have had that battle in the past when the government was looking at whether or not to keep the licence fee going on. That's always, I know, there's always a bit of a buzz around Parliament about that debate, about whether that should happen. But actually, I do think that there is a legitimate issue about having publicly funded broadcasting. If you only do it through commercial measures, there's a danger that you miss out on some of that important public service broadcasting. So you'd have to find a way of delivering that if you ever got rid of a license.
That's true.
What's the money they're spending here? Yeah.
I get all that, but I think it's such a huge organisation now and has fingers in so many different pies, which never, you know, it's a bit like the EU. Nobody quite knew it was going to expand into, you know, sort of web-based news. Nobody knew it was going to have apps like Sounds. Nobody knew that it was going to have all sorts of, you know, online activity, which was nothing to do really with television. And so, you know, a lot of people think some of that could be hived off.
Well, some of it is, of course. They have BBC Commercial, and they're also doing collaborations with like ITV on a new sort of Netflix rival, I suppose, where they both put up their own...
Oh, this is BritBox,
isn't it? Their old programme. BritBox, exactly.
That sounds like an idiotic idea to me, I have to say. I mean, why would you want to pay money to watch something you've already watched?
Well, you have BBC, was it the old... Gold TV, TV Gold, whatever it's called.
Yeah,
the
one you don't
where
pay for that,
everything anyway. Well, no, that's true. But actually, the problem is the BBC in the past sold the stuff that we'd paid for through the licence fee too cheap.
Yeah.
And then they haven't benefited from that. So at least this time, we would say to the committee, well, you're seeing the value of what you produce and trying to make some money out of it, which would hopefully keep the licence fee down.
But don't they make money selling
it
now?
We watch that too.
But don't they make money now selling that stuff to Netflix and Amazon and others?
Well, they do sometimes, and sometimes they're actually doing co-productions with Netflix in this slightly bizarre world. So I think your point is perfectly right and valid, that they are now a much more complex organisation doing things that you're a commercial station that actually compete with the commercial world. They have a commercial arm. We now are able to look at that and how they spend money there as well, which is a new thing for Parliament to be able to do that. We have access to some of their information, and I think that's important too. So we do push them, and I think there is they are not neither one thing or the other. They're paid by the licence fee, but they've got this commercial arm. There's a bit of a mix of things going on there.
Yeah, because they launched a channel in Scotland the other week, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, and that's partly because actually my Scottish colleagues here will say, well, we want more money spent in Scotland. It's taxpayers' or licence fee payers' money.
Well, they would say
we want
that.
Our shares, but no. Yeah, exactly. You know, so this is the thing for the BBC. They get it always, whereas I don't think people say that to ITV because...
No,
you know,
no. I mean, the only group of people who are more vilified than the BBC are, of course, MPs, of which you are one. I mean, how's that feel at the moment?
Well... I have to say, this is not a good place. But, I mean, I think that you've got to remember that the executive decides what Parliament can vote on. So it's very frustrating being here as one of 650 MPs.
Yeah.
And having... Sometimes you have a power when you get a vote, one vote out of 650, but it is difficult to influence the agenda. We can try. We are trying in various ways. But, look, we've got, 9 days to go now and no package at the moment. I'm very worried for my local businesses and my constituents. We're seeing prices already go up in the shops. The uncertainty is not good, and we do need to get... to a resolution.
Yeah.
So obviously tomorrow in Europe with the Prime Minister is going to be pretty key, but
I'm not holding a great deal of confidence, but what I do think is good, and it may well be that I get proved wrong about this, it wouldn't be the first time, but there is a lot more engagement going on between MPs and their constituents and indeed the general population. Even if they hate you, at least they're watching you.
Oh, well, yes, certainly. I didn't sort of come here to be a celebrity on the telly. I don't think most of us did, but actually, because most of us are engaging all the time. But I think actually, you're right, there is that level of engagement. That's a small positive, but it's only for bad reasons, because we're not normally, if you're getting on and doing the job properly, people are, much less interested in it.
Yes, well, that's right. Exactly. They don't really know what you get up to. So anyway, listen, good luck. And Meg, thank you very much indeed. Keep an eye on those people. Don't let them spend our money because, we're all trying to make a living out here in the commercial sector. You know, it's not very easy for us.
Okay, I'll bear that in mind. Thanks
Thank you very much. Meg Hillier, Chair of the Public Accounts Select Committee there, saying she's going to keep an eye on this £27 million overspend. I will guarantee you, despite Meg's good works and despite all of the watchful eyes that are on the BBC, they will somehow find a way to spend even more money between now and 2023, which is when the new EastEnders set is going to be ready. Surely to heavens, they could have built a real town for that kind of money, couldn't they? Rather than just an EastEnders set, and actually put people in it who can live there. Let's talk to Susan in Exeter. Hello, Susan.
Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon. How the devil are you?
Not too bad at all, thank you very much. I was just saying to your lovely producer, one of them, Marta.
Marta, yes.
Look, basically, I left school at 15, but I've got a rough idea when people don't like me and things are going wrong.
Mm.
I think it's time to put Mrs. May out to grass.
I agree.
Because basically, nobody's agreeing with her. But the problem is, Mike, she's very cerebral, unlike myself.
I think she might think she is.
She
has, you know what she doesn't have? She has no emotional intelligence.
Well, I was going to say something different. I was going to say she has no intuition. She's not in touch with what people think about her, or
no.
She just doesn't care.
No, you're
but
right.
It's not working. It's not working because she has to listen to what people think about her and what people care about her, because that influences what how people react to her. And she just doesn't have it. She doesn't have intuition, does she?
No.
You know,
she seems to have no understanding either. Of
well,
the
no.
fact that, as you say, people don't like what she's proposing.
Well, because she's stick. I wonder what birth sign she is. I wonder if she's like my sister. I wonder if she's Taurus, because when Taurus have got a bee in their bonnet, they dig their heels in, and the worse you go at them, and the more conflict they face, they just dig their heels in like a little bull in a field.
Yeah.
You know, they dig their heels in, and I'm getting that with her, unless she's Capricorn. But
she's 1st of October, which I think makes her. I think that makes her not a Libra. It might be Libra.
No. Well, I'll have to look in the thing. I've got the thing here. But she's not listening. And it's very antagonising and disruptive to people because she's not listening. She doesn't have this. But you see, she's talking about what's good for the country, what's best for the country, and her beautiful clear-cut glass vowels. But why did she get rid of all the coppers off the streets?
Well, it's a good
you
question.
Know, that wasn't good for the country.
No.
You know, these people, they're sitting up in their ivory towers. She goes home to her darling Philip, which is lovely. They're very much in love still. They have a wonderful marriage, which is to be admired.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to finish up with what can only be described as today's Libra horoscope for Theresa May. It says this: at work and home, reaching out to people gets you the cooperation you need. As the sun moves into this part of your chart where deals are done, a signature on a contract means a lot to the family. If you're ready for a new relationship, passion smiles where special awards or prizes are announced. I can only say, Susan, that you've inspired me there. Thank you very much indeed. Theresa May, I'm afraid the horoscope isn't really coming true because the deal isn't working. But thank you very much indeed.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio, via DAB, online or via the Talk Radio app. If you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.